From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Picture a crack pipe against a grainy image of a Latino candidate for mayor, playing the race card in the race for mayor in Los Angeles, Jim Hahn versus Antonio Villaraigosa. We'll talk with the head of the L.A. School Board, also a young Latino activist, and an organizer whose independent union is holding both candidates' feet to the fire. And 20 years ago, the first cases of AIDS were reported in this country. Now AIDS is a leading cause of death among young African Americans. Today, look at the changing face of AIDS. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republicans will relinquish control of the Senate to Democrats today as a result of the decision by moderate Senator James Jeffords of Vermont to bolt the Republicans and become an independent. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle is in line to become the new majority leader. He promised this week not to block consideration of Bush's agenda, but said he would push for Democratic proposals on education, health care, and other issues. As part of the battle, Senate Republican leader Trent Lott has begun a campaign to discredit Democratic claims that they will hold the majority. The shift in Senate power means the chairmanships of all but one of 20 permanent committees will go from Republicans to Democrats. The U.S. Supreme Court, for the first time in 12 years, yesterday overturned the death sentence of a Texas prisoner, said by his lawyers to be so mentally retarded he still believes in Santa Claus. By a 6-3 vote, the court threw out the death sentence of Johnny Paul Penry, a convicted killer whose IQ is said by his lawyers to be between 50 and 63, below the standard of 70 for normal intelligence. They say he has the reasoning capacity of a 7-year-old. The majority opinion by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said the jury instruction was ineffective and illogical and did not allow jurors to consider mitigating evidence of Penry's mental retardation and childhood abuse. Penry's scheduled execution last November became a political issue during the disputed U.S. presidential election. President Bush, then the Texas governor, was widely criticized over the state's use of the death penalty and what critics said was his failure to give the case the attention it deserved because of his focus on the Florida vote dispute. Penry's execution would have been the 150th during Bush's 6 years as governor. The court action followed a barrage of international criticism, with the Vatican, the European Union, and politicians from several countries complaining that the United States was flouting the norms of international civilized behavior by executing a mentally retarded man. In Cambridge this week, Harvard Law School has reprimanded 4 students who were involved in this spring's 21-day sit-in over minimum wages for Harvard employees. The reprimands will be listed on their transcripts, and the students will have to explain both their actions and the punishment whenever they apply to a state bar to practice law. The students and one of their lawyers complained yesterday that the law school had trampled their due process rights. They also said they feared that the sanctions may hurt the students' careers. And they said that the action smacked of retribution, noting that Harvard College gave only probation to about 25 undergraduates who took part in the 3-week occupations of Massachusetts Hall last month to demand a living wage for all university workers. A report by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights has concluded that disenfranchisement of Florida's voters in November, quote, fell most harshly on the shoulders of African Americans in a presidential election marked by, quote, injustice, ineptitude, and inefficiency. The confidential report by the independent federal agency repeatedly urges the U.S. Justice Department and Florida's Attorney General to immediately investigate whether Florida officials violated state or U.S. law by employing policies and practices that unfairly harmed minority voters. The report says, quote, despite the closeness of the election, it was widespread voter disenfranchisement, not the dead heat contest, that was the extraordinary feature in the Florida election. Key portions of the report were obtained by the New York Times. The report went on to say the disenfranchisement was not isolated or episodic. State officials failed to fulfill their duties in a manner that would prevent this disenfranchisement. African American voters were nearly 10 times more likely than white voters to have had their ballots rejected in Florida. Of the 100 precincts in the state with the highest number of disqualified ballots, 83 are majority black. Overall, 54% of the ballots disqualified were cast by black voters. The panel sharply criticizes the president's brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Secretary of State Katherine Harris, and other Florida officials for neglecting widespread weaknesses in the voting system and failing to prepare for increased voter turnout. The advisory commission has no power to enforce its findings. Several tobacco companies were found guilty of deceptive business practices this week in a case brought by Blue Cross Blue Shield, which sought to be reimbursed for funds allegedly spent on smoking-related costs, as a jury ruled that the companies must pay about $29.6 million in damages. In the case, a third-party payer complaint on behalf of health care plans, Blue Cross Blue Shield sought reimbursement of alleged smoking-related medical care costs that were incurred by its health care plans. Blue Cross sued in a Brooklyn, New York court for direct claims on their own behalf and on behalf of their subscribers. Among the defendants in the case were Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Holdings, British American Tobacco's Brown and Williamson. New York-based Philip Morris said its part of the direct and non-direct liability damages totals about $11 million.
Come into the city carrying life in my eyes amid rumors of death, calling out to everyone who would listen, it is time to move us all into another century, time for freedom and racial and sexual justice, time for women and children and men, time for hands unbound. I had come into the city wearing peaceful breasts and the spaces between us smile. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes. And they followed us in their cars with their computers and their tongues crawled with caterpillars. And they bumped us off the road, turned over our cars. And they bombed our buildings, killed our babies. And they slaughtered our doctors, maintaining our bodies. And their courts changed into confessionals. But we kept on organizing, we kept on teaching, believing, loving, doing what was holy, moving to a higher ground, even though our hands were full of slaughtered teeth. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace.
Stay on the battlefield, Sweet Honey in the Rock, with poet Sonia Sanchez, here on Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. Picture a crack cocaine pipe being held up to a flame, followed by a grainy image of a Latino man. You just can't trust Antonio Villaraigosa, the ad concludes. Now picture leaflets accusing the former labor organizer of child pornography and sex crimes paid for by Native American-owned casinos where Villaraigosa has backed the rights of workers to form a union. If you can picture this, then you get a sense of the challenge Antonio Villaraigosa poses to political tradition in the nation's second largest city. Meanwhile, his opponent, City Attorney James Hahn, has largely disappeared from public view as one of the most fiercely contested mayoral elections in decades draws to a close. Antonio Villaraigosa is an immigrant son and former labor activist with strong roots in Los Angeles's organizing community. He's the former speaker of the California State Assembly. Villaraigosa's progressive ties have energized an unprecedented multi-ethnic coalition of labor and community organizations, while his work in the state assembly has garnered the support of more moderate political forces and some of Los Angeles's wealthiest citizens. If elected, he would be the city's first Latino mayor in more than 130 years. Villaraigosa's opponent, James Hahn, is a longtime city attorney whose father served for 40 years on the County Board of Supervisors in Los Angeles and whose legendary patronage forged a strong following in the city's African-American community. Polls indicate that James Hahn has the support of more than 70% of the city's African-American residents, including progressive congressional Representative Maxine Waters. While both are considered liberal Democrats, it's Hahn that's attracted the majority of the city's more conservative voters, although according to his critics, through ads that highlight race and a lingering public bias against Latinos. LA's mayoral election is still considered too close to call today, but the rise of Villaraigosa and the broad support he's won marks a profound shift in the political landscape of a city that is now nearly half Latino and increasingly a bellwether for progressive politics around the country. We're joined today by three guests. Luis Sanchez is an organizer for Youth Organizing Communities. Cynthia Rojas is an organizer for the Bus Riders Union and the Labor Community Strategy Center. And Janethia Hayes is chair of the Los Angeles School Board and former executive director of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Council. Let's begin with Janethia Hayes. At this point, polls indicate that Villaraigosa, or I should say Jim Hahn, has more than 70% support in the African American community. Can you explain this appeal and why you've taken a different stance?
Yes, and good morning. Thank you for having me. The appeal in the African, first of all, I want to say to you that 70% number is really soft, and it's not, I don't know that that will hold. But having said that, the appeal for James Hahn really has much more to do with his father, Kenneth Hahn. Kenneth Hahn, needless to say, I've lived in the area since 1958, and of course, Kenneth Hahn was that county board of supervisor. He was the supervisor who actually oversaw a mostly, largely African-American supervisorial district, and he was absolutely a legend. There's no question. He cared for the district. He brought needed change into a supervisorial district. He made sure that when things happened in the county, they happened equally in his district. He pulled together a great deal of our transportation planning that made it easier for people to get around by bus and on the freeways and those sorts of things. He is the person who made sure that there was a large regional park that began to happen shortly before his term of office was up and shortly before he left office. Actually, his term wasn't up, but he declined to run. And so when you think that the most likely voter, when you look at the profile of the most likely African-American voter, it's going to be that 60-year-old woman who is most likely going to go to the polls. And my belief, as I watched James Hahn politicking and campaigning, he's campaigning in the African-American community on his father's coattails. He understands very clearly, as well as all of us do in Los Angeles, what the prototype is of the most likely voter. It's that 60-year-old woman who knew his father, who lived in his father's district, who remembered his dad, and James Hahn, who for the 20 years of public life, I've never known him to say James Kenneth Hahn. And if you were to be in Los Angeles, if you were to look at his signs, he is now politicking and he is now campaigning on James Kenneth Hahn. And so it, more than his record in public life, it is this raising of his father's, the specter of Kenneth Hahn, who is absolutely, yes, much beloved in the African-American community. I have chosen Antonio Villaraigosa for a variety of reasons. Number one, I believe that a person should campaign on their record. And I know Antonio's record. I've known him for 20 years, and I've known him to be a person who pulls people together. I've watched him work when he began with the teachers union and went on to the ACLU and went on to the state assembly, and I know the legislation that he's passed, and I know him to be a person that pulls people together. And he is campaigning on what he's done, not on what someone else in his family has done. Jimmy Hahn, during this entire campaign, for example, hasn't really talked much about his record, about what he did when he was a city attorney. He talks about gang intervention. He talks about gang suppression. From my perspective, that's really not what one would want from a city attorney. One would hope that a city attorney could talk about how you prevent young people from being involved in violence and being involved in gangs, and how you'd spent your money and how you collaborated with other city agencies to provide a seamless network so that young people had a way not to be involved in gangs and not to engage in gangs. You talk about the innovations of your own office. City attorney is one of the most powerful offices here in Los Angeles. And quite frankly, during the entirety of the campaign, James Hahn has not talked about his record in public service. Antonio has spent his time talking about that, pulled together a coalition across ethnic lines, across geographic lines in Los Angeles. And then if you look at this last kind of, when Antonio was actually doing very well and people were beginning to see this campaign of hope that he was putting forward, if you look at these last 2 to 3 weeks and this negative advertising and these negative ads and the negative mailers that, in my opinion, not so subtly, are race baiting and creating fear in people. When somebody gets a mailer, when somebody looks on television and sees a Latino with cocaine, with a crack pipe, with a picture that is unflattering, from my perspective, that calls into question what Sam Yorty did to Tom Bradley, what Bush did, Senior Bush did to Michael Dukakis with that Willie Horton-esque campaign. This was about fear.
In a nutshell, though, Janethia Hayes, what is it about Antonio Villaraigosa that appeals to you? What is his politics that have convinced you to vote for him?
Well, the main thing, as I've said to you before, really is politics of inclusion. Antonio has convinced me, and because I have a 20-year relationship with him, it wasn't difficult to do, but Antonio has stepped out of, I'm a Latino candidate, and I'm going to make sure that I push a Latino agenda in Los Angeles. What he's saying to the city is, we are a multi-ethnic, pluralistic city, and we need to be pulled together. We need to have this whole city brought together from our disparate communities, from our disparate ethnic backgrounds. We all need to be pulled together, and I am in favor of that. We are the most diverse city in the country. And either we're going to do something with our diversity or we're not. And if we're going to do something with it, we need a mayor who understands that, not just downtown, not just worrying about the valley, whether it's going to secede. But do we find in which one of these candidates do we find who has not only talked about pulling people together, but has a track record of doing so?
Janethia Hayes is chair of Los Angeles School Board, former executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Council in Los Angeles. Cynthia Rojas, you're an organizer for the Bus Riders Union and the Labor Community Strategy Center. What stance have you taken in this race, and what about the supporters of these candidates? How does that affect your decision?
Well, good morning, Amy. Basically, in this election for mayor, the Bus Riders Union has worked with all the mayoral candidates from, you know, before the primaries up until it was only Antonio Villaraigosa and James Hahn running. We worked with them in order to get their support and also, you know, not so much to endorse them, but to get their commitment that as mayor, they would take the right stand on our specific issue, which is public transportation and forcing the Los Angeles Metropolitan Transportation Authority to fulfill a consent decree that they have signed with us. And we've been impressed with the response that we've gotten from both mayoral candidates. Both of them have pledged that as mayor, they would fulfill the consent decree, that they would buy the buses required to fulfill the standards set in that contract. And Antonio Villaraigosa has actually even gone a step further to call for the reduction of fares. Right now, the fare is $1.35. He is supporting a 50-cent fare, $20 passes, which is significant because these are demands that we've been placing on the MTA for the last 7 years in order to decrease the cost of public transportation for the working poor, for the working class Latinos and blacks who are the majority on the bus. And so he's coming out with a very strong transportation a program. So in our case, in the Bus Riders Union, we have been seeking the support of the candidates and, you know, thanking them, being thanking them for taking the right stand. But at the same time, we do recognize that we are an independent force. We don't fully depend on elected officials in order for us to build the power or the base that we have. And therefore, when they do things like James Hahn in running this campaign, which I do agree it is a campaign around fear, and it is a campaign that has been using race baiting and these types of measures in order to build a negative image of Antonio Villaraigosa, we are constructively criticizing that type of actions and behavior from James Hahn, and at the same time recognizing that, you know, Antonio Villaraigosa is not going to, when he gets into office, it's not as if we're just, you know, going to end our struggle there, and, you know, we're not going to have to struggle with him throughout his mayorship if he becomes mayor. But
Cynthia Rojas, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll also be joined by Luis Sanchez when we come back, an organizer for youth organizing communities, and ask how involved he's got involved with this mayoral race. Our guest, Cynthia Rojas of the Bus Riders Union, Labor Community Strategy Center there. Janethia Hayes, chair of Los Angeles School Board, coming up, Luis Sanchez. After that, it's the 20th anniversary of AIDS, and we're going to talk with three African-American men, because in the African-American community, AIDS continues to rampage, particularly through the young population. And we'll find out how they're dealing with this epidemic. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the race for mayor in Los Angeles, today is the vote. Tomorrow we'll be joined by Harold Meyerson, who is the editor of the LA Weekly, to talk about the results. This extremely tight race between James Hahn and Antonio Villaraigosa. And by the way, that name is a new name, Villaraigosa. He combined his own name, Antonio Villar, with his wife's name, Raigosa, to put it together as Villaraigosa. Luis Sanchez, you're an organizer for the youth organizing communities. What stance have you taken in the race?
Well, myself and youth organizing community, we never really take a stance, and we don't deliver our members or go out and say, we're going to support Hahn or Villaraigosa. But at the same time, we want to make sure that both candidates are held accountable around issues of education and also around issues of criminalization of young people. And one of the scary things we've been seeing is, over the last couple of weeks, is the campaign that you guys have mentioned that Hahn has put out, that one plays on the fears of people in the Valley and the West Side, that's saying that people of color and young people of color are the reason why there's crime in the city of Los Angeles. And there's a lot of race being going on, and what Hahn is doing is putting out the fear into the minds of the people of the West Side that people of color are the criminals of the city. And in response to that, what Villaraigosa is having to do is defend his stance on crime, which both, by doing both things within the campaign, are playing into the issue that both young people of color are in the middle of the crime wave here in the state of California, would play into passing bills like Prop 21 here in the state of California. And that's what we are scared about, that when both candidates are trying to defend their stance on crime, what ends up happening is it lowers the bar and begins to label once again that young people of color and men of color are at the forefront of the rise of crime here in California. And we have been at the forefront of defending that issues like Prop 21, which passed last March of 2000, should be overturned, and that we should be calling for schools, not jails, and education as a human right. And I think this campaign has begun to do is to say that, playing to the fears of a lot of California people and people in Los Angeles, that young people of color are the criminals of Los Angeles, and we need to create laws that make sure that they be kept down as opposed to creating alternatives. And even though Villaraigosa is saying that we need to create alternatives, over the last week he's had to defend his stance on crime, which makes us fearful of how he's playing into the Han campaign.
What about James Han's history as the city attorney, basically the city prosecutor, and his relationship with the much-tainted LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department?
Yes, I mean, that's another fear. I mean, Han, for us, represents the whole idea of injunction and gang injunction in the city of Los Angeles and putting them in, and also at the same time never really holding the LAPD accountable for the whole Rampart scandal in Los Angeles. And what that has allowed is, one, the injunctions allow for the criminalization not only of the gangs within Los Angeles, like the 18th Street gang and other gangs in Los Angeles, but also it allows for the criminalization of young people of color all over Los Angeles, because the way it's created is, if you're in a group of three or more and you're walking around, you could be labeled a gang. And there's a lot of young people of color who are on the gang database based on the idea that they fit the profile. And fitting the profile is a very general term, and a lot of young males of color in particular fit that profile on a daily and get pulled over. And a lot of young people of color do not even know they're on the gang database. And I think, one, Han, because of the injunction he's been able to pass and create all over Los Angeles against gangs, it also affects the larger society of young people of color in the city of Los Angeles. And at the same time, Han has not held accountable the LAPD and really has kind of shied away from holding them accountable, which allows them to say, oh, it's all right. And they just slap their hand and continue doing the work they do, which promotes, one, the injunction, one, Prop 21, and one, and third, the worst thing, the criminalization of young people here in Los Angeles. Hmm.
Cynthia Rojas, do you think as a result of the TV ad campaign that James Han is running, by the way, I should say we did call the Han campaign, we're hoping to get someone on from the campaign for Han, but we're unable to do that. But do you think with this emphasis on the grainy pictures of Villaraigosa with set against a crack cocaine pipe that it has caused him to move away from fully identifying as a Latino, I mean, making that a major issue?
Definitely. I mean, throughout the race, Antonio Villaraigosa has been not only really criticized, really criticized for being progressive.
Go ahead, repeat the last point.
Not only has he been criticized for his history in the ACLU, for being a progressive, et cetera, but really he's been explicitly criticized for his ethnicity, for being Latino. A lot of these really right-wing reactionary voters in the San Fernando Valley or in the West Side have expressed that they will vote for Han because he is white and because they feel, I mean, that he will protect the English language, he will represent them. And so Antonio Villaraigosa has had to express how much of an American he is. And in some ways, I mean, he is not running as a Latino politician, in my opinion, from judging from what I've heard in his interviews, in the way he's had to campaign. And frankly, the reason why he needs to do that, not necessarily that I agree with it, but the reason he needs to do that is to push back on this idea that he is only going to represent the Latino community in a city that is almost 50% Latino, but not 50% of those people, not 100% of those people actually vote. So he does have to appeal to the white vote, to the more conservative vote, and campaigns like the campaign that Han is running is feeding into that. And that's what is so disappointing in seeing the way Han is running his campaign. And it's also disappointing seeing the way Antonio Villaraigosa is responding, the way Luis had referred to how he is then trying to defend his record on crime. And what would that mean once he actually gets into office? Does he have to prove that he is as tough on crime as a white politician? I mean, as Han would be. And as a Latino mayor, he is going to have to face a lot of that. And right now, we are seeing him push back a lot on even being called the first Latino mayor in modern L.A. history. So we have seen that affecting even the way Antonio Villaraigosa relates to himself.
And what about the well-off and powerful supporters of Villaraigosa, like Mayor Richard Reardon, his top economic backer, Eli Broad, Gordon Murley, president of Woodland Hills Homeowners Organization, and others?
Well, it is worrisome that while Antonio Villaraigosa has the support of labor, of progressives, of environmentalists, at the same time in this, you know, in his strategic coalition building, he is also including conservatives and multi-billionaires like Eli Broad, like Ron Burkle, who have, you know, who have an extensive history in Los Angeles. And, you know, Antonio Villaraigosa is being then criticized on one hand for potentially creating an anti-business climate in Los Angeles because he is being backed by labor, but on the other hand, then he's responding to that by getting the support of these types of forces. And it's not as if he's just getting this verbal support. I mean, he's financially being backed by these forces, thousands of dollars being put into his campaign. And so we do have to think about what is that going to mean once he is mayor, if he does become mayor, and he has these types of forces that he owes politically to, what would that mean for the working class of Los Angeles, who he also owes to, but who do not have as much of that type of political push on them? And that's why with the Bus Riders Union, we are trying to build an independent force of working class Latinos and blacks and Asians in Los Angeles who will push these elected officials, you know, to take more progressive stands on the issues that the working class have historically needed to struggle on.
Janethia Hayes, your response as chair of the Los Angeles School Board.
Well, let me say that I understand all that's been said, and I've been listening very carefully to both of my other guests, and having been a candidate for public office actually less than 2 years ago, and having the support of wealthy people from the West Side, I mean, I pretty much put together the same kind of coalition that was put together for Antonio Villaraigosa. The real question and the real issue is the character of the candidate. Anybody who runs for public office understands that, unfortunately, in a place like Los Angeles, it requires a large amount of money in order for you just to get your name out there and in order for you just to be a viable candidate. And the real question becomes whether or not your integrity is going to allow you to do the job that you want to do based upon your moral and your ethical persuasions. It is my belief that Antonio can do that. I serve on the school board. I'm the president of the school board. I was endorsed by the mayor. I was endorsed by and given a great deal of money by the Coalition for Kids. And I have been an independent school board president. I think that when you have a person like Antonio Villaraigosa, who has 20 years of being a labor organizer, working for the ACLU, having put forth some of the most progressive legislation in the state of California during his term in the assembly and as a speaker, I mean, this is a man who pulled Republicans and Democrats together. There's no question that we should always keep that at the forefront. One always has to remember who supported someone. But if you're really looking for, this actually goes to my scenario and to my perception of Antonio about a person who brings people together. He's got a Republican mayor. He's got Eli Broad. He has Ron Burkle. He has labor. He has those of us who are trying to build a progressive political coalition in Los Angeles to look at and to talk about not just what's going to happen to wealthy downtown in the business community, not just to how do we hang on to the valley, not just to how do we increase the fortunes of the people on the west side and in Westwood, but we also now have a guy who's going to look at those communities that are east of downtown and south of downtown, south central Los Angeles, the east side of the city, where we need to make sure that we have transportation, where we know that we need to create jobs and stability in communities. He's going to be a person who I believe who will work with the school district, for example, to build these 85 schools that we need to make sure that young people get educated and so that they have hope and they are not going to have to join gangs and be criminalized. And so if you ask me, that for me, his record and his history of what he's done will help him to resist any event that some of these folks who have given large amounts of money come and want him to do things that will, in fact, more balkanize Los Angeles. That is my great belief, and that is why I'm such a strong supporter.
On that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Janethia Hayes, chair of the Los Angeles School Board, Cynthia Rojas of the Bus Riders Union and Labor Community Strategy Center, and Luis Sanchez, organizer for Youth Organizing Communities. The race for mayor in Los Angeles, the runoff is today between Jim Hahn and Antonio Villaraigosa, and we'll be joined by Harold Meyerson tomorrow, editor of the LA Weekly, to talk about the results. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we go on now to AIDS. It's, some are calling it the 20th anniversary of the discovery or the understanding that something very big was about to hit communities around the world.
What I harbor you, would you harbor a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a
Would you harbor me, sweet honey in the rock, here on Democracy Now! 20 years ago today, the Center for Disease Control's weekly report ran a short article under called Pneumocystis Pneumonia, Los Angeles. It began in the period October 1980 to May 1981. Five young men, all active homosexuals, were treated for biopsy-confirmed pneumocystis carini pneumonia at three different hospitals in Los Angeles, California. Two of the patients died. The case studies followed. Patient one, a previously healthy 33-year-old man, developed P. carini pneumonia in March 1981. After a two-month history of fever, the patient's condition deteriorated despite courses of treatment. He died May 3rd. Patient 2, a previously healthy 30-year-old man, developed P. carini pneumonia in April 1981. After a five-month history of fever each day, his pneumonia responded to a course of intravenous treatment, but as of the latest reports, he continues to have a fever each day. Patient 4, a 29-year-old man, developed P. carini pneumonia in February 1981. He did not improve after being given intravenous treatments and died in March. The report didn't draw much attention. A month later, another issue of the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report described hitherto rare cancers in another 26 gay men. A third report, published that August, tentatively wove together some of the threads. The clustering of those diseases among gay men suggested a common underlying factor. That common factor, HIV, was discovered in 83. Much has changed in the past 20 years. According to the CDC's latest report, almost 500,000 people, most of them gay men, have died of AIDS in this country alone. That is 100,000 more than died in World War II, and almost 10 times as many fell in Vietnam. For years, activists fought for funding of AIDS research and treatment. The White House was silent, not wanting to touch what it perceived as a gay disease. This year, the national budget for AIDS research is $2.2 billion. Safe sex and the acceptance of gays became not only a public issue, but a matter of life or death. But the face of the disease, the communities it affects, have also changed. In the early 80s, AIDS was mostly a, quote, white disease. Now half the newly infected men in the United States are African Americans. Blacks are 10 times more likely than whites to be diagnosed with AIDS and 10 times more likely to die from it. Each year, 15 out of every 100 young black, gay, or bisexual men is infected. AIDS is the leading cause of death for young African Americans. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by three men talking about AIDS. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. That music break was Bobby McFerrin, Common Threads, the AIDS Quilt. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we're talking about AIDS, 20th anniversary since the CDC acknowledged there was something they didn't understand going around this country. And we're joined right now by three men to talk about it. Guru Kurugu is with us, who's coordinator of the New York State Black Gay Network. He is an African immigrant on the board of the Audre Lorde Project and has been doing HIV work since 1988. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
What are your thoughts today?
We're actually having a quarterly meeting. The network is 10 organizations from across the state, and I'm meeting this weekend, and we'll be looking at the issue. It's an actually somber moment for most of us. I'm glad you talked a little bit about some of the statistics, but 20 years and what we're seeing within our particular populations of African-American or men who have sex with men of African descent, our numbers have continued to go up. A recent study indicated, just to show you how alarming that number is, indicated 32% infection rate out of a sample of a study called the Young Men's Survey right here in New York City. And 32%, you need to understand, it was 32% for African-American young men who have sex with men between the ages of 22 and 29, 15% for Latinos. You need to understand that's compared to, let's take Masaka in Uganda, which was once the epicenter 10 years ago, which has only about 13.8% infection rate. That's an incredibly, incredibly high number. Why? So at this stage, at 20 years into this epidemic, we're observing this very somberly, trying to figure out what it is that we need to do.
Mark Tuggle, you're with Gay Men of African Descent. When were you diagnosed?
December 19th, 1994.
How did it affect you?
I was devastated. I thought I was going to die. You know, I was flooded with thoughts of sickness and hospitalization and opportunistic infections, and I just felt really hopeless. I was angry with God. I was confused. I was completely demoralized. And after about 4 months, I began to think about, well, maybe I may make it, you know, because I wasn't getting sick. And I was waking up every day, and I decided to change my attitude and to get involved in service.
So what are you doing?
Well, I'm on no meds. Stop smoking cigarettes. Don't drink. I've surrounded myself with friends who are positive. And I work in the community, so I'm very active. I pray, I meditate, I try to have fun.
What about the response of people in the white gay community to you as an African-American man with AIDS who is gay?
The response? You know, I have mixed emotions about this, and Girl was talking about a somber tone. At GMAT, you know, we're not only dealing with homophobia, but we're also dealing with racism. We're dealing with the stigma, and there's so many different complications. And it's really difficult because a lot of the clients that we have are dual and triple diagnosed. So they're dealing with issues around substance use and criminal justice issues as well. So it's difficult because the prevention messages are not culturally relevant. They don't reach our community. The messengers don't reflect us holistically.
Guru, what do you think are the most effective ways to reach the gay African-American community and the African-American community around issues of AIDS?
And I guess why we said somber is a lot of things that we know work we've known for many years. The shift of the epidemic started over 10 years ago. And part of it is there's simply not been resources targeted to create prevention for our populations. It's not, we often, I mean, our new mantra is that this is not rocket science. The white gay population was taught the world when you have sustained high-level prevention messages that hit you from all over the place, whether it's on the bus or the bar, and wherever, it works. That has not happened. So on some level, the ability to get resources and actually get the information out on the street, peer-led, GMAT and other organizations in our city and actually across the state have some amazing prevention programs, but simply do not have the resources to get the word out. And again, as Mark talked about, we're also talking about not just HIV. There are issues of race and issues of access to care, access to information, et cetera. We are marginalized populations on many levels. So it cannot just be a singular message. It has to be a more holistic way to reach folks.
We're going to go out to Oakland, California, to Tim M.T. West, who is a writer, a poet, a hip-hop artist, an activist, also known as 25%er with the Deep Dick Collective. Let's start by listening to one of his songs, Vaxacran.
Deep, too hurt, too weak. I'm asking you to chill, Bill. Stop and drop your pretense. We can't make sense of your need for context. Descriptions of prescription filled at Walgreens, the Rite Aid, my aid, my nigga's illness be still with a course of war spill. Sitting on his windowsill in a wheel like G. Gordon. See, it's important that I holler from L.A. to the North. Long day dollars be collard greens, blacks and reds, backwards heads and they actual facts. My normal snowstorms now. Warm December's finding me reminding my brothers to remember to take their meds. Best to rest and stay in your beds. He resists when niggas want to twist raps about busting caps and faggots with naps. I feel trapped by my dreads, running laps on a treadmill quick enough to sicker get sickened around me while everybody in the ads a smile. A liver failure, edema and dry mouth and palpitations of miles away as all the days when I spoke in codes. Speaking spell of weak T-cells and viral loads and flexes euphemistic of opportunistic infections. Wagness abounds around sounds of blackness optimistic. The fact stands man and woman in the land in a planetary tax bracket can't stand it. Thought that you could beat that untreated stomach cancer and you're thinking that Vaxacran's the answer. Your life is calling you JoJo dancer, cause you a go-go dancer, and nothing can stop your body. Part of me scared to party, so a hand job and knob slide the hotties. His fantasies of a man in me seem to be less problematic than my need to suck the skin off. I've been offered and profited by you. Seems like you've been off more than you had the teeth for, cause I don't fake at the Grand Lake, State Lake, the Lakeshore Core Regimen. Choke down the clown fungal spores, numerous cystitis, phlebitis, and more. Lying cloth on me down on a 12-city tour, hoping we don't open no more doors for you. And of course, coping and roping in your notion that DDC be the source of your angst and thanks for the memories and the mammy-made milk of your ill. When I bust up your party field with silk toast silk. For real though, the lab says I'm negative, but I'm not positive. What have I got to give? Cause Glaxo welcome, set it as I bring it. Tie red ribbon around my ding-a-ling. Sing it in the most delightful
away. In the most delightful way.
Vaxacran by Timon T. West. Also with Sexual Minority Alliance of Alameda County, SMAC. Tell us a little about the song.
I guess I should first begin by stating that that's actually a member of my rap group, DDC, whose name is Juba Kalamka. So that's not me rhyming. It was a song that we created, however, about we wanted to address inside of hip-hop context, HIV, and essentially Juba is my roommate and one of my artist friends and another activist who wanted to talk about his friendship with an African-American man living with HIV and some of the contradictions in the HIV drug industry, sort of as a way of sort of putting out a lot of what we're dealing with. I think the line that really stands out to me, and that is the labs say I'm negative, but I'm not positive, and how HIV and AIDS has really become this phantom of sorts that just sort of hangs over the heads of a lot of African-American gay and bisexual men. And part of why it does so is because we really don't create enough spaces to talk really openly, honestly, and frankly about it. And that's one of the things that I try to do as someone who counsels young people at SMAC Youth Center, is to create a different kind of conversation. I mean, with regard to what was being said earlier, I would question whether the same kind of prevention and intervention strategies that have been effective for the white gay community are indeed effective for African-American gay men. I personally think that that's where the conversation needs to begin. I don't think that the same kind of intervention and prevention is working. It's not a matter of just access to information or, you know, condom distribution. I mean, those are, I think, old, tired methods that just don't work. And so I'm interested in sort of forging more cutting-edge conversation about, okay, what does prevention look like for this population? And for me, a lot of that is love yourself, love yourself, love yourself.
The piece in the San Francisco Chronicle on you yesterday said 25 years after HIV first appeared in America, the face of AIDS has changed, and it looks a lot like Timon West. Through his teen years and early 20s, a smart and angry hip-hop artist living in Oakland kept his sexuality on the down low, a term some African-American gay men used to describe being in the closet. You were already an AIDS activist and educator when you were diagnosed HIV positive in 1999. So you've been teaching about this for years.
Indeed, I think, and that's part of where my conversation comes from. And I don't think that's an anomaly. I mean, I think a lot of people who've done work in the African-American gay community and who have done HIV prevention education work, it's not surprising when I find that another one of my brothers has also tested positive. And I think that that really shows the what may seem a contradiction or ironic to some, but it's just that the issues around HIV and transmission and unprotected sex and why people would put themselves at risk go back to a lot of psychological and social traumas that we experience as African-American gay men growing up in a society that does not validate who we are as sexual beings. And dealing with a lot of racism, so the compound effects of racism and homophobia and oftentimes sexism and classism on top of that really create a situation where you're constantly struggling to find love and affirmation. And oftentimes that takes form of a sexual relationship. And, you know, to be honest, at the moment notice of, you know, putting on a condom versus, you know, being caught up in the sort of euphoria of someone loving you, oftentimes that decision isn't made. And I think that's the harder conversation to have.
Guru Kruger, you've been whispering and nodding your head as you listen.
Absolutely. It's critical. Actually, when I used the analogy about the level of the intervention used by the white community, it was not so much that that would be appropriate for our populations. That's clear. It was actually more about the level of the amount of resources that were used to do that. There's a very different approach, and we've had examples, we've provided examples of how to do this for many years, and Tim is absolutely correct. Within the network, and we are a network of 10 organizations from across the state, our biggest challenge is to actually create spaces for folks and to actually assist people and assist organizations to provide culturally competent interventions for so that, I mean, I'm completely in agreement, because the context of HIV, and I think I've just said this before, cannot just be seen in terms of just HIV and condoms. People's lives are a little more complex than just that.
Mark Tuggle.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really important that you look at the whole person, and historically we haven't been seen as a whole person with very diverse needs and wants. One of the things that we do successfully at GMAT is we have a group called Sex and Sexuality where they meet twice a month, and they talk about issues around orientation and preference and gender identity and sexual identity. They talk about going to the park. They talk about going to the bathhouse. And they talk about being safe, you know, going in pairs and not carrying a whole bunch of money and wearing flashy jewelry. You know, we give people tips, you know, and we create a space where people can talk, like Tim said, openly and honestly about sex to alleviate a lot of the shame and the guilt and the misery and the pain that people have been suffering in so long, because quite often most of us have grown up in communities where we haven't been encouraged to talk about sex at all. It becomes a secret, and that adds to the stigma.
Do you even refer to yourself as gay?
You know, that's another whole issue.
I don't.
We don't. We actually refer ourselves as same gender loving men. And that's the other cultural context issue. So, again, we can't use some of those early models. But I do want to make a real point, and that is the issue also of a homophobia. I mean, I know we've talked a little bit about how we as black men who have sex with men engage with the world, but homophobia within our own populations has had major, major impact. I mean, that is a public health issue. So when you have a black man in a society in which black men are simply not valued, I mean, all black men, straight or gay or whatever, to then have to deal with other issues of being homosexual or maybe being a substance creates levels in which people have to negotiate their lives that are very, very complex. So I think homophobia needs to be, however people, I mean, has to be seen. And part of what we're doing with our organization is actually, is the issue of visibility. I mean, going to our politicians, we go to every parade in our different boroughs, not just the gay parades, but our ethnic parades. We're present. And making clear to folks that, you know, we're here. Our office is in Harlem, thank God. We're on 125th Street.
Right.
So it's really about we're here. You know, we're part of the community. We've always been part of the community, actually, but being more visible about that.
Tim and West, if people want to hear your music, where can they go on the web?
The best place to go to hear music from DDC is they can go to www.mp3.com/DEEPDIC. So,
well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we'll put that on the website at webactive.com. And I want to thank our guests in the studio here in New York, Guru Karugu, coordinator of the New York State Black Gay Network, and Mark Tuggle with Gay Men of African Descent. And that does it for today's program. We'll put your contact information on the web as well at www.webactive.com. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson, Anthony 1857 Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled sub-studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!